The Second Vatican Council gave us a brief description of what it is we do here Sunday after Sunday. It put it this way: the Mass is the source and the summit of all Christian life. If that is the case, and it is the case, the Eucharist is also the source, is also the summit of our private life of prayer, if we know how to read it, if we know how to understand it. It's also the source and summit of our own private prayer. The Eucharist is the prayer for us who call ourselves Catholic. It is where prayer begins. It is where prayer ends. It is the ideal form of every prayer. It is the way we ourselves should be praying. To deepen our understanding of prayer, that's really the task of any priest when he talks to you. To deepen the understanding of prayer is to deepen your understanding of what happens before, during, and after the celebration of the Mass. It is the source of everything. It is the summit of everything. And we don't know that. We often forget that. So let me simplify the way you think about that this morning. Let me simplify it for you by calling to mind an episode in the life of a man named David Jones. He died in about 1974. We knew him in his professional life, his career. We knew him as an engraver, extraordinarily gifted man with the art of engraving. We knew him as a soldier. The soldier in the First World War, he was in the British infantry. We knew him as a painter. Many fine works came from his brush. And we knew him as a poet. And that's where I first discovered him, as a poet. In the middle of his career, he wrote an epic poem called the Anathemata. In this poem, all 240 pages of it, we think of poems as little short things. He went on for page after page after page, complete with full footnotes that were almost a page in length as well. This poem is built basically on the Mass, built basically on the Eucharist. And the opening line is what I will share with you today. The opening line is this: we already, and first of all, we discern Him making this thing other. The opening line of the poem. And I didn't know this when I first read it, but I learned later where that opening line came from. It came from an episode in his career as an infantryman. Very early in the war, he was sent to France to be at the front. And very early in the war, he had his left leg shattered when he was wounded by a German shell. He was in the hospital for a while. He recovered well enough. He was away from the front for a specified period of time, and then he returned. And when he returned one day, he was wounded in 1916, and when he returned early in 1917, he was back at the front in France, and his mission that day was to go through the various parts of no man's land and to find dry wood for firewood, okay? And as he was walking around in the desolation, he came upon what we in this country would call a barn. I think the Britishers speak a different language than us. It had a different name, but it amounted to a barn. It was a shell-shocked, shell-destroyed barn, but it was still in use today. And he went up to this barn, and he pushed around on the sides of the barn and made a little hole for himself to see what was in there, see if there's any dry wood in there. And this is what he saw, he explained in a letter to a friend. He saw two wavering, gusty candles in this barn. And he saw in this barn the back of a man near the candles in the barn. And the man seemed to be dressed in some strange, exotic fashion. He gave it a name, actually. He said he was dressed in liturgical vestments, such as I am now, such as Deacon Carson is behind me and Father Brian is today, okay? Dressed in liturgical vestments. And the man was facing, instead of toward him, was facing a stack of ammunition boxes covered with a large white cloth. Okay? This is what the Anglican David Jones saw, the Anglican who was not much interested in his church, in the way his church functioned. This is what he saw looking through the wall of that barn. And he saw further on the floor around the man, half a dozen men in muddied tunics, their uniforms, kneeling on the straw-covered floor. And he heard about this time the tinkling of a small bell, followed by faint words, mysterious words in a language foreign to him. In Latin. That was when he realized that this was a Catholic Mass going on in front of him. And he said it seemed to him like an image of the Last Supper. He knew about that. He never before had such an experience at his Anglican services, but he knew about that thing, that sort of thing. And he was most impressed by the unity he sensed among those men and that priest. That jumped out at him I have to tell you that David Jones was a very shy young man, very shy as a young man, shyer than he was as an older man. Very shy as a young man, and he found a great deal of camaraderie with the people in his military unit. He hungered for that unity. He thirsted for that kind of friendship, those engaged in that awful work of war. He was impressed, sensing the unity between priest and men in the mass. So closer to the front line, in a panorama of utter desolation, he saw there a great marvel. And it touched him deeply. It remained locked in his memory for the years that followed immediately thereafter. And he did, toward the end of that year, meet with a priest who was assigned as a chaplain to another military unit, visited with the man about it, discussed the question about the meaning of the Mass, took some counsel from him. The man gave him a book by St. Francis de Sales, one of the classics of our Christian faith. And later, David Jones, in 1921, joined the Catholic Church, was baptized conditionally, and became an ardent member of the Church for the rest of his life. And at the high point of his life, when he wrote this epic poem, this is the thing he really remembered. I said, the whole poem is built upon the unfolding of the Mass. The Mass for him, David was a very fine artist, and the Mass for him was really a work of art. The way it was structured, the way it unfolded, the mystery of it, the drama of it, all of that was a work of art for him, a little bit like a stage performance of a group of dancers, possibly. This had all the signs of a work of art for him. And that's when he wrote this opening line. We already, when you come into the Mass, if you come late, never happens, of course, but in some Catholic churches it does. When you come into the Mass, you come a little late, you see him, first of all, making this thing other. Those words, this thing other, that's what I want you to grasp on today. That's what I want you to reach out and grab today. I want you to take away with you. Making this thing other. What was he talking about? The hymn, obviously, that Jones saw was the priest moving toward the consecration of the Mass. The bell was a telltale sign of that. Moving toward the consecration of the Mass. Moving toward what? Making the bread we use other than it was. It remained bread. To our senses, it remains the bread. It looks like bread. It tastes like bread. But in this moment, it is made other than it was. It is the body of Jesus Christ. He watched this man through the barn wall. He watched this man making the cup, what was in the cup, other than it was. It looked like wine still. It tasted like wine still. But it was not wine still. It was other than it was. It was the blood of Jesus Christ poured out in sacrifice to redeem the world. What he saw in that barn, what he tried to capture in that opening line of that large, lovely poem, what he tried to capture was the otherness involved in this business of the Eucharist. Okay. And he went a step further, I think. Not only did he make the bread other than it was, not only did he make the wine other than it was, he tried mightily to make himself other than what he had been when he started. He knew, as every priest knows, because we fail so often, he knew what a sinner he was. He knew how often he ran the other way. He knew how often he did not live up to what the Lord had ordained him to do, to make these things other. He knew that. And so he prays every time before he says those fateful words. He prays that he will be made other here and now in this mystery. He prays for that because he knows without the grace of God, if that it will never happen without the grace of God. He will never get out of his sinful ways without the grace of God. He prays for that for himself. So he can say those words with a full heart and mean those words with a full heart. And then he does something else. He prays too in that same prayer for all of you in this church today. Every priest and every mass prays for those who are there today. And he prays the same thing for you as he prays for himself. He prays that you, good people, blessed people, baptized people, already changed people, that you will really be changed. That you will really become other than you are. Because he knows you as he knows himself. He knows you to be caught in a web of sin, as all of us are because we inherit original sin from our parents. And we add to that, year by year, day by day, we add to that by our own personal sins. He prays that you may be made other. You who are most dear to him, you who are closest to him, he wants you to be other the way he wants the Lord to make him other. And he prays for the whole church. The church is always rent by factions, always torn by controversies, always nitpicking about this and fighting over that. He prays that the church may really be one, really be at peace with one another, all its members. He prays for that every day when he says these words. And he prays for the whole world outside. He prays for all the things in the country that he loves, the country where he lives, the country where he's from, given him so much education, life and education and experience and all that sort of thing. He prays for that too. So how does it work? Very simply, how does this prayer work, this making other, how does that really work? Well, in the world of the sacraments, it works very simply. It works as the reverse thing from what you would normally expect, okay? He works with bread, he works with wine, he works with the food that we normally eat. And what happens with the food that we normally eat? In life, we take a bite. We eat the food. We take a drink. We drink the food. In life, we do this. We eat the food and it becomes us. The whole mysterious process of digestion, whole mysterious remaking of a pour, it pours out in the energy we have to make it through the day, to make it through the week, to make it through the month. We eat the food and it becomes us. Okay? That's the way we normally expect the food to work. But in the world of the sacraments, we eat the sacred food, the bread already changed, the wine already changed. We eat the sacred food and we become it. The reverse of what normally happens with our food. Just the reverse. We eat the sacred food and we become it. But to put it more accurately, we become him. Jesus Christ, whom that bread has become. Whose sacrifice that wine has become. We become him. That's the heart and soul of this liturgical rite we come to Sunday after Sunday. The heart and the soul of it. We become different from what we were when it started. We become more Christ-minded. We do dearly hope that happens. We become more Christ-souled. Taking on the very soul of Christ himself. We become more Christ-bodied. That's what happens here. If you blink, you miss it. If you don't know that, you miss it. If you don't know what a challenge it is to you to allow yourself to be changed, to become other, you miss it. That's the heart of it all. That's the magic of it all. We sometimes... You have the experience, I have the experience. You can be in a small church. You will have eaten a number of hours before you come to church, the Mass normally. And you can come in the very quiet of a small church, you can hear the priest's stomach rumbling, or you can hear your own stomach growling, right? That's process of digestion taking place. So you can ask yourself the very simple set question, what does resurrection sound like? It sounds like that. The rumbling, the growling, the warming of your stomach. The whole process of digestion can lead to that kind of thing. Digestion is the humble beginning. It is how resurrection, being made authentically other than you really are, that's how it sounds. To enter the mystery of the death and resurrection of Christ is, to put it very simply, to become other than you are. St. Paul put it that way in his letter to the Romans. He said, "You died to the law through the body of Christ, that you might then thereafter belong to that other," the figure of Jesus Christ, the other who was raised from the dead. This is what the Mass is about. This is what we need to be about. And I think I would just call your attention to a simple thing you heard Deacon Carson read in the Gospel. The man who was rich had no name in the Gospel. The man who was poor, Lazarus, he had a name. Lazarus had a name, the rich man had none. And that's the real shocking thing about this lesson. It's surprising you don't normally have figures given names in parables, but the shocking thing is one man has a name, the other man has not. Okay. And I think the point he's making is that when he came to die himself, when he came to see things more plainly for how they really work, what he came to see was he was treating the poor man, even after his own death, he was treating the poor man the same way he treated him on earth. He didn't take the trouble to learn his name. He didn't take the trouble to know his name. All he meant to the rich man was to be someone who could serve him, to make his life easier, his life more livable. He didn't have any other meaning beyond that. In life, he treated him that way. In death, he treated him that way. And that's the thing that should shock us. He was so absorbed in himself, so full of himself, that he didn't even know it. And the best way he could have come to know it was to learn the poor man's name. He did not do that. He was close to that. He needed mightily to be made other than he was. And he didn't do it. The poor man had a name. The rich man had none, because there was nothing there. The otherness the Lord wanted of him was absent, was missing. He lost his chance.